Yes, Dr. York. Please, start from the beginning.
Very well. To calculate an ascent track, we have the following equation for the acceleration in the direction of the flight path. V equals delta V over dt equals F1 plus AE1 times PE1 minus PA. Now, the F1 is, of course, referring to the thrust of the first booster. That was calculated at, as you can see further down in the equation, 12.8 times 10 to the 9th g's of thrust. I glanced at the bench. Senator Mason's eyes had begun to cross. Am I going too fast?
No, no, not at all. Carry on.
And I did. By the time I finished, they either understood or pretended they did, which was actually more useful for Nathaniel's purposes. I didn't throw up. Not even once. And the cherry on the cake? Senator Mason asked for my autograph for his granddaughter. It would have been nice if that had ended the inquiries, but my testimony at least allowed them to move from who to blame to budget. 3 weeks later, I stood outside Director Clemens' door. Even from the hall, the stink of his cigars announced that he was in. Taking a deep breath, I stared at the ceiling. The Milltown was not a miracle pill, or my heart wouldn't be racing, but it helped. I could do this. I had an appointment. This was only one man, and not a congressional committee. Letting out my breath, I rounded the corner and smiled at Mrs. Kerr. His secretary looked up from her typewriter.
Oh, you can go right on in, Dr. York.
Thank you. When had she started using my title, and why? In his office, Director Clemens bent over a stapled report, one of his cigars clamped between his teeth. Behind him, Parker scowled.
Oh, please. Like, that'll work?
I stopped in the door. I'm sorry. Am I early?
Oh, no. Come on in.
Clemens waved me into the room, and I realized that there was another man here. Tall and blonde, he looked somewhat familiar, but in my shock, I couldn't place him.
You know Lieutenant Parker. Have you met Werner von Braun?
Oh, God. That was Werner von Braun. Rocket genius and Nazi scientist, sitting in a chair by the window. Nathaniel had worked with him years ago, but I knew him only by reputation. They'd brought me into a room with a literal Nazi. Had that been Parker's idea? Probably. How do you do? Saved or damned by social niceties, I was able to make it through his response, which I barely heard, and even shake his hand. Yes, I'd heard the stories about how he wasn't really a Nazi, about how he had been forced to use Jewish prisoners or risk losing his own life. But he'd made that choice. 1, 3, 6, 10, 15, 21, 28.
Colonel Parker suggested that we might need some assistance in understanding your report.
Clemens waved at the chair in front of him.
Have a seat.
Did Clemens even know I was Jewish? I sat and smoothed my skirt as if I could rub the taint of von Braun's touch off my hands. If I walked out of the room, my chances of convincing Clemens were over. I take it that you were concerned about Nathaniel's impartiality?
Exactly so.
He leaned back in his chair.
Now, explain it to me very slowly, like I'm a congressman.
Wetting my lips, I nodded. I hope you'll bear with me if I start with a history lesson, which is not in the report. It will give some context. Clemens waved a cigar, smoke trailing it like a plane going down.
Go ahead.
When sewing machines were first introduced, people were frightened because they were new and moved with an unprecedented speed. There was concern that you could go blind from watching the machine. So the manufacturers made them beautiful. They added gilding and floral motifs. Parker snorted.
So you want to send some lady astronauts up as decoration?
As we explained to the congressional hearing, our goal is to expand humanity to other worlds. You will need women on those worlds, or they will never be self-sustaining colonies. I glared at Parker. I trust you don't need me to explain the biology of babies?
Babies or no, it's not safe.
Parker shook his head and smiled.
I appreciate your ambition, I really do. But surely the Orion 27 accident demonstrates that we can't put women in the line of fire.
No, that is the wrong tactic to take. If you point to the explosion as a sign that rocketry is not safe, the space program will fail. I looked back at Director Clemens, but with the cigar in his mouth, it was hard to read his expression. You know it will. If you want to demonstrate that the program is safe, then you need to demonstrate that these rockets are safe enough even for ladies. Parker shrugged as if none of that mattered.
And we will, after the moon base has been established.
I pressed my hands flat against my skirt to keep me from balling them into fists. If you refer to page 6 of my report, after World War II, there is no shortage of women who flew as WASPs and have the right skills. But if you wait too long, those women will be too old, which will raise the barrier of creating the colonies.
She has a point.
Werner von Braun, of all people, stepped into Clemens's smoke cloud to support me.
The Russians used their night witches at the war to devastating effect.
Parker tilted his head at the mention of the Russian women's air squadron.
I always thought they were propaganda.
Propaganda, perhaps, to begin with, but real and effective.
Von Braun shrugged.
And even propaganda has its uses. We want the space program to continue, yes?
Propaganda. Yes, I was well aware of what propaganda could do. Clemens grunted and tapped his cigar in the brass ashtray on his desk.
All right. So, let's go through this point by point.
I took a breath and stood to join Parker behind Clemens. I kept both of them between me and Von Braun. Not because I thought he was going to pick me up and haul me off, but because it sickened me that people forgave him for what he'd done simply because he was a brilliant rocket scientist. A nice man. A gentleman. Yet here I was, giving tacit approval to his presence by saying nothing. Because if I did, then Parker would use that to talk about how hysterical women were. And worse. If the space program failed, then humanity was going to be trapped on Earth as it got hotter and hotter. So I leaned over Clemens's shoulder and turned to the first page of my report. Right. We begin by looking at the budgetary benefits of using women as astronauts, due to our lower mass and oxygen consumption. And from there, it was all about numbers, and I was home. 26.
Robot designed to explore moon. Six-legged crawling device would report over TV. March 22nd, 1957. What has six legs, one claw, television, and sleeps 16 hours a day? It could be a robot exploration vehicle small enough to be landed on the moon in a Project Reconnoiter package, according to a report to the International Aerospace Coalition yesterday. A working model of the proposed moon crawler has been built. The full-sized object would stand about 5 feet tall on its walking shoes, weigh 110 pounds, and be powered by little more than a square yard of solar cells.
The first launch after the hearings was unmanned. It was a requirement that came out of the hearings and a smart thing to do when you're still trying to make sure that your system is robust. In our department, we computers had always employed a safeguard procedure, in that any calculations intended for a rocket were looked over by two other women. In the past, we had sent it to the Air Force, and they had used one of their men to transfer it to program cards, and that was that. Now, two computers would look at the output of the IBM machine's run to make sure no errors had been introduced. It was fairly straightforward. The first launch went smoothly. The second launch was manned. No one was treating it as though it were straightforward. Oh, we were all pretending like it was business as usual, but you could have ignited the atmosphere in the glassed-in viewing area above mission control. I wasn't on duty this shift, but there was no way I was going to miss the launch. If this launch went smoothly, the astronauts would demonstrate that the lunar module could dock and rendezvous with the command module. We could go back on schedule, and we'd be another step closer to the moon. If it didn't, then we'd have killed Derek Binkowski, Halim Maalouf, and Esteban Terrazas. There was a whole range of possibilities in between, including a launch abort or just scrubbing for weather. Those lesser evils were not the things filling anyone's minds as we milled around the viewing area. At T-minus 4, the wives and children of the astronauts would be escorted to the roof to watch the liftoff from there. It would also sequester them from the press if things went badly. We all laughed and chattered, pretending that nothing could go wrong. All of the astronauts and their wives, except Parker's, had turned out for this one to support the men in the capsule. Mrs. LeBourgeois separated from her husband and floated across the room to me. She was a diaphanous blonde with a long neck like a swan's, and a tendency to purse her lips into a kittenish pout. But she smiled when she saw me and came up to give me a kiss on each cheek.
Ah, my dear, our daughter is still talking of you. Not even her father is so impressive.
She should be impressed with him. He's been in space. I just dream about it.
It will not be so long for you, I think.
Her swan's neck bent down in a curve as she winked.
My husband, he is making me take flying lessons so I can be ready.
That was optimistic and more than a little charming. Has he heard anything?
No, she pouted. But he has told Director Clemence that he believes women should be included. I think he just wants to, you know, have his wife in space.
Her hand covered her mouth as she giggled at what must have been a stunned expression on my face. My mouth hung open a little, and then I laughed with her. It had not occurred to me that one tactic would be to appeal to the male astronauts about the benefits of marital duties in space. Oh, my heavens. Maybe I should try to talk to all the wives.
Oh, we talk amongst ourselves.
I'll bet. Have you met Mrs. Parker?
No. She is always ill with something or another, or busy. I think she just does not want to spend time with foreigners, but who am I to guess, hmm?
She gave a little shrug and dismissed the absent woman.
Did you know? The weightlessness, it does, how shall we say, interesting things to our husband's anatomy? The blood flow is quite, unrestricted by gravity.
Well, now I want to get my husband into space. I glanced through the glass window to where Nathaniel stood hunched over his desk. They should really just make his station a standing desk, since he had trouble sitting when he was tense, which was always. Wait. I couldn't hear them. They'd turned the speakers off. When had they... Something was wrong. Nathaniel had the phone pressed to his ear and a broken pencil in one hand. Clemens stood at a different phone and was clearly shouting. Randy Cleary, the astronaut manning the Capcom desk, was talking into his headset and making soothing gestures with his hands as if the astronauts in the capsule could see him. The countdown clock had stopped at T-minus 28. Other people had noticed and were moving toward the window. Mrs. LeBourgeois caught her husband's sleeve as he walked past.
Qu'est-ce passe-t-il? Je ne sais pas. Ce ne fut pas une explosion, une nous aurions senti.
He winced and looked at me.
Dr. York can tell you. An explosion we would have felt, is that not so?
Yes. It's probably just a glitch that they'll get sorted out soon. I smiled at his wife. Honest, we have to stop launches all the time. It might just be the weather. Except I'd been on the floor when there was a weather scrub, or a cutoff switch failed, or system didn't come online as expected. We had procedures and manuals that were inches thick on what to do in every possible contingency. Everyone stayed aggravated but calm. Whatever was happening down there was not routine. I leaned closer to the glass looking for Basira, who was on duty for this launch. She was leaning together with Myrtle. Both women had dropped their pencils and looked shocked. Behind me, Parker spoke.
All right, everyone. There's no need to be concerned. Nothing is wrong with the rocket.
I turned along with most of the rest of the room. He stood next to one of the couches, holding the viewing room's phone receiver in one hand. I wouldn't have called down to bother them, but I guess the first man in space had more privileges than I did. He hung up the phone as we all leaned forward in anticipation.
It's just a weather delay. Things are in a holding pattern.
That was a lie. I knew what a weather hold looked like. If it was weather, you'd see a lot of bored engineers spinning in their chairs. I opened my mouth to challenge him, then shut it again. This wasn't the time. Parker caught my eye and gave this weird little nod, almost like he was thanking me for not interfering. Something was very, very wrong, but I trusted him, which surprised me, to have a compelling reason for wanting the lie to stick. I turned back to Mrs. LeBourgeois and laughed, shaking my head. Oh, weather delays are the worst. There's nothing you can do but wait it out.
I am glad that it did not happen when Jean-Paul went up. I should have died from the waiting.
Well, the astronauts will probably just take a nap. I kept having to pull my gaze away from the window. When Cristiano Zambrano went up, we had a 2-hour delay, and I actually heard him snoring. Someone approached, and I stepped back a little to let them enter our circle of conversation. Stetson Parker stood next to me. He smiled, showing his outrageous dimples.
You wouldn't expect a person to sleep under these circumstances, but the couches are custom-made to fit our bodies. Surprisingly comfortable. Say, Mrs. York, may I borrow you for a moment? Got a question about your lady astronaut speaking engagements.
I met his gaze and smiled as brightly as he was. Of course, Colonel Parker. My first thought was that something had happened to Nathaniel. We stepped a little away, facing the window so that our backs were to the viewing room. My husband was still talking on the phone. Every moment I looked down there, I became more convinced that something terrible had happened. Myrtle had tissues out. Parker leaned in, voice low.
I'm trusting that you're not going to scream.
Gee, thanks.
There's a bomb.
He glanced from me to where Binkowski was standing by the switch for the speaker.
There's a man with a sign and explosives, and he's strapped himself to the gantry. That's all we know.
1,000 questions ran through my head. How did he get out there? What kind of bomb? What would happen if it went off? Copy. What do you need me to do?
I want you to get all the wives and children to the cafeteria without scaring them. Keep them away from the press.
He glanced over his shoulder.
Especially Maloof's and Binkowski's kids. Keep them from hearing anything until the situation is handled.
Of course. Their fathers were on the rocket waiting for launch. Have they told the astronauts?
I don't know.
He grimaced and looked down at Mission Control's floor.
It looks like that's what Cleary is doing, though.
I'll tell the wives, discreetly.
I wouldn't.
He shrugged.
Astronauts' wives already have to live through enough stress and worry for a lifetime. Save them this.
It was tempting to make a comment about his own absent wife. Later. I could score points later. I spun away from him, clapping my hands.
Ladies, I'm going to suggest that we adjourn to the cafeteria where I'm told there is cake. It will be a much more agreeable wait than in here.
I do not do well when there is a problem that I can't do anything to solve. The 2 hours we waited in the cafeteria were awful. I spent the entire time listening for an explosion. Listening for an explosion while trying to amuse small children who had been promised a rocket launch and were long past their nap time. Mrs. LeBourgeois's daughter was an unexpected help, even without knowing what was happening upstairs. She borrowed tin foil from the chef, and I sat next to one of Mrs. Binkowski's little boys and helped him smoosh tin foil into a pointed column.
Good! That can be the body of your rocket.
While I was chattering with children, I was trying to mask all the questions stampeding through my brain. What was happening upstairs? What could I do? My tactical training consisted of listening to my father and his friends tell war stories. What would my father have done? Stormed the gantry? No. Sat next to a 5-year-old who was making a mess of his fuselage? Maybe.
Oh, Max, that's very good.
The cafeteria door opened. All of our heads turned toward it as if we were in a formation drill. Parker entered, followed by Binkowski, Maloof, and Terrazas, still in their flight suits.
Daddy!
The little boy next to me abandoned the table and ran across the cafeteria, holding his tinfoil rocket up in the air.
Look what I made!
His mother was slumped against the table, eyes closed and crossing herself repeatedly. I stood more slowly, letting families reunite. I somehow managed not to scream, "What happened?" Instead, I tidied tinfoil. That's right. There had been a bomber threatening the space program, and I spent that time making rockets and cleaning up tinfoil. I turned my back on everyone and began gathering up the supplies we'd been using. Little scraps of foil littered the table where Mrs. LeBourgeois had shredded them while chattering idly about a film she'd seen recently. Parker swept some of the scraps into a neat pile.
Thank you.
Stopping, I stared at him. What happened?
The astronauts used the emergency slide. When they were clear, the Air Force moved in.
He glanced over my shoulder to the happy noises of children being adorable. That's it? The Air Force moved in?
They shot the bomber.
Parker's gaze hardened on mine.
He was opposed to abandoning God's creation on Earth. The rocket was a sin and a violation of God's plan.
I bent my head and shredded a piece of tinfoil, finding satisfaction in tearing the metal. Well, I'm glad that's over.
Good work, by the way.
Lifting my head, I stared at Parker. He stood at ease in a well-tailored suit that hinted at the blue of flight suits, though not quite as vivid. His hair was a little mussed, which was unusual for him. That is, I think, the first compliment you have ever given me.
It's the first one you've earned.
The muscles in my right arm burned with the desire to punch him. The urge pulled the breath out of me. If I moved at all, I would lose the battle, and I'd never punched anyone before, so I had no idea if I would be any good at it. Do you practice being offensive, or do you come by it natural? He winked.
For you, I practice.
Parker looked past me to smile and wave at someone.
I'll be honest. I needed someone who knew how to talk to women and children, and while I may not like your whole lady astronaut routine, you do it well.
Two compliments in one day. You're slipping.
Then let me leave you with this. You're never going into space if I have anything to say about it.
That was so much blunter than anything I had expected from him. Sniping at each other, sure. But actually coming out and saying he'd keep me grounded? I couldn't even fire back. Why?
Really?
He shook his head, brows drawn together.
You tried to have me court-martialed, and you think that's not going to have consequences?
What? I never tried. What are you talking about? He spread his hands on the cafeteria table and leaned toward me.
What exactly did you think was going to happen when you reported me for conduct unbecoming an officer? Did you think I wasn't going to go on trial? Please. You're a general's daughter. You know exactly what happens with that kind of charge.
Yes. I kept my voice clipped and low, conscious of all the kids behind us. Yes, it gets ignored. I wasn't the first person to report you for harassing women.
You're the only one I know about.
Parker pushed back from the table, spreading his hands as if he could brush it all away.
And when they looked into it, you know what? None of the girls had a problem with me. None of them.
A laugh came out of nowhere. They were afraid of you. They were afraid they'd be grounded.
And you weren't? Please.
I wasn't, because, as you say, I was a general's daughter. I shook my head and backed away from him. How did you ever get anyone to marry you? Or maybe that explains why no one ever sees your wife. His face hardened and closed.
My wife is off limits.
I'll bet she is. I turned my back on Parker and walked over to rejoin the other wives. Anger was shaking my veins with the force of my pulse. Bastard. Self-centered, self-righteous bastard. He thought he could keep me from joining the astronaut corps? I'd like to see him try. And then the anger bled into cold resignation. He already had. And it was working well. The IAC sent Nathaniel to a hotel that night with a military guard just in case someone decided to take a shot at the program's lead engineer. That was a depressing thought. I went with him, and the agency sent someone to our apartment to get clean clothes for us. He sat on the edge of the hotel bed in his stocking feet, staring at the carpet. I sat next to him, leaning into his warmth. Can we pretend this is a vacation? Nathaniel laughed, sliding an arm around my back to pull me closer.
The agency is doing something wrong. We have to change the way we're selling the space program to the public.
There's always going to be someone who disagrees.
Someone with a bomb?
He flopped back onto the bed, pulling me with him.
I think we're going to relocate the center.
I was willing to follow Nathaniel to whatever random place his thoughts took him. Turning so that I was on my side, I nestled against him and rested my hand on his chest. That seems a little extreme.
Clemens was already talking about it before this. He was going to use the Orion disaster to try to get us away from population centers.
May I put in a request for somewhere equatorial?
Still trying to get a vacation, huh?
Trying to get better orbital trajectories. The button on his shirt shifted under my hand, and I rolled my fingers around it. Where were you thinking?
It's all Clemens. I just build the rockets. While we were waiting for the situation to resolve,
which was such an engineer way to describe a bomber,
Clemens was going on about how many jobs we create. I don't know. It might actually turn into a bidding war.
So equatorial location and a pony? His hand came up behind my back and pulled me closer.
You know, I kept having flashes of what it would have been like if you were on that rocket.
Well, that's a worry you can put out of your head. I rolled away from him to stare at the pebbled plaster ceiling. It might be the surface of some unfamiliar planet. Parker declared today that he was going to do everything in his power to keep me from being an astronaut.
What?
Nathaniel sat up, staring down at me.
He said what? What exactly did you think was going to happen when you reported me?
I cleared my throat. He said something about how I was never going into space if he could help it. But, sweetie, don't say anything about it.
Don't? Why the hell wouldn't I?
I sat up to face him. Because it was just him and me. No one else heard, and you know how he can play things off. As the first man in space, the agency had good reason to want to keep his image spotless. If they had to sacrifice a computer for him, I knew what would happen. And Daddy wasn't here to make sure it didn't. Besides, at the moment, they aren't even accepting women as astronauts. When they do, then we'll talk about it. 2 months passed. The U.S. committee that had looked into the crash finally voted to continue the United States' involvement with the IAC, in part, I think, because they were afraid the other nations would colonize the moon without us. And there were changes, of course, which we implemented over the winter. Higher security at the IAC required a fancy new electric fence and armed guards roaming the edges. Clemens used the bomb and the Williams Farm tragedy like budgetary weapons to get upgrades and add staff. As Nathaniel predicted, the IAC pushed to relocate the launch facilities to Brazil to limit vulnerabilities. Mind you, we'd asked for this at the beginning, but hadn't been able to get building a new launch site through the budget because the U.S. was afraid that other countries would use rocket technology for weaponry. The rockets would be assembled and tested at the Sunflower facility in Kansas, then shipped to the new center near the coast in Brazil for launch. It finally got us near the equator, which was going to help with the Moon and Mars programs. And it meant that the computer department was busy redoing all of our trajectories to account for the new launch site, although it would likely be another 2 years until it was fully operational. I was hunched over a page double-checking my differential equations when a shadow fell across my desk. Blinking, I looked up. Nathaniel stood by my desk. He had that serious, constipated expression as if there were a secret he couldn't share.
Sorry to bother you, Elma, but I thought you'd like to see this.
He laid a single sheet on the desk in front of me.
It's a carbon, so you can keep it.
Across the table, Basira lifted her head and gasped. She was staring at the same line I was.
Press release. IAC director announces new call for astronauts. Women encouraged to apply.
Someone shrieked. That was me. I had jumped up and thrown my hands into the air like I was some sort of gymnast. Around the room, the other computers had stopped, pencils frozen mid-equation. They were staring at me and I didn't care. They're taking women astronauts! Pencils, laughter, papers, and hurrahs filled the air. My fellow computers jumped up and hugged each other. We were all laughing and crying and it was like the war had just ended again. I grabbed Nathaniel in a hug that left him gasping. He kissed me, bending me over in a dip that defied gravity. At the door, engineers poked their heads through the door to see what all the hoopla was about. Bubbles bounced into the room. What in the... Lady astronauts! I shouted from my husband's arms. The lady astronauts are headed for orbit! 27.
Superfuel to drive rocket indefinitely in space. April 18th, 1957. A breakthrough on the path to a superfuel for rockets that will drive themselves indefinitely with an atomic oxygen captured in the upper atmosphere was reported last week by Peter H. Wyckoff, rocket specialist at the Air Force's Sunflower Research Center. Oxygen in the upper atmosphere consists of molecular oxygen, each molecule composed of two atoms of the element. However, in the region 60 to 70 miles above the Earth, ultraviolet rays split the molecular oxygen into single atoms. Dr. Wyckoff reported a catalytic agent has been found that would cause the recombination of the atomic oxygen in the upper atmosphere into molecular oxygen, such combination resulting in the release of great amounts of energy.
I had not been to the 99s in months. But the Sunday after Nathaniel put the draft of the press release on my desk, I went, and I took applications with me. Walking across the tarmac to our hangar, the scent of petrol and black tar whipped around me on the breeze. Such a strange combination of scents to be nostalgic for. No one was sitting on the picnic bench outside the hangar, which wasn't surprising, with October's first chill in the air. Nicole's Cadillac was parked near the door, so I knew at least one person was there. Outside the small doors set in the bay doors, I stopped, almost tempted to knock. Then I shook my head and pushed the door open. They were using my plane, and I still contributed to the rent, so it wasn't as if I were a stranger. I stepped through into laughter that dissipated as I took off my hat. Pearl looked up from a slice of cake, and her gaze widened. "Well, hello, stranger!" Or maybe I was a stranger. When Pearl stood, she had an obvious bump, which said that her triplets would soon have a new sibling, or two. I waved, a little sheepish, that I hadn't known. "Hi." Ida Peaks and Imogene Braggs were at the table, along with some women I didn't know. There were more planes in the hangar, too. One of the Mustangs seemed to have made its way over, and a P-38 Lightning. Whose was that, and how could I become their best friend? Nicole had been perched on the end of the table with a cigarette held lazily in one hand. She stood when she saw me, smiling. "It's about damn time." And Betty. She kept her gaze fixed on the table. But Helen bounced up from the table, grinning like I'd given her the best present. "I was just telling them." Of course, Helen had been in the computing department when we got the news. "Well, just remember, it's not public yet. The press release won't go out until Tuesday."
"I won't tell anyone."
Betty spoke to the table.
"If that's what you're implying."
To respond or not to respond, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler to suffer the bait of defensive posturing or to... "Hell, I wasn't worried about that. You're good at keeping secrets when you need to." Nicole stepped between us.
"Now, girls."
She hurried over and gave me a kiss on the cheek.
"I'm so glad you're back. You get me hooked on flying again, then up and vanish. It's too much, really, darling."
"Anyway," I fished in my bag, "I have the applications for the astronaut program." Women surrounded me like a bank of clouds. One minute clear skies, next zero visibility except for a flurry of white as the pages were whipped away. The laughter that had been present before I came in resurfaced, bouncing off the walls. Though not all of the cries were of delight. "Advanced degree?" One woman's shoulders drooped. "I didn't even go to college." As quickly as they had surrounded me, the women dispersed to fill out their applications. I had already filled mine out. It was sitting in a box on the secretary's desk outside Clemens's office. Helen had snatched one from my hands, too. She'd seen the announcement, but not the application form. The grin sagged off her face.
1,000 hours in high-performance aircraft, with 400 of that as pilot in command? And 50 hours of jet time? How? That's not fair! What woman has that?"
I winced. "I do. A lot of the wasps do."
"Chemistry counts? Oh, my God. Oh, my God."
Ida Peaks bounced on her toes.
"I have a master's in chemistry, and I meet all the qualifications, God damn it, except for the high-performance aircraft."
Imogene stared at her application as if she were trying to decide whether to kiss it or flush it.
"Same. I keep thinking about Sarah Coleman and how she was asked to withdraw her application during the war."
"They can't ask us to withdraw if we don't even qualify."
Imogene nodded, still staring at the document.
And the reason that only white women qualify is because of that policy decision about the WASPs. This is an extremely neat way to keep the astronaut corps all white while pretending that it's open to everyone.
That hadn't even occurred to me. I blinked, trying to decide what to do or say. But before I could get my thoughts in order, Ida snorted.
Well, that's bullshit. And I bet Dr. King will have things to say about it. Very loud and pointed things.
Ida turned back to the table.
I need a pen.
With a flourish, Imogene raised her pen.
Got one right here. And you can have it when I'm finished filling this damn thing out. 50 hours pilot in command of a jet aircraft, my Aunt Fanny's ass. The spaceships aren't even jet-powered, are they, Elma?
They're not. I hesitated, not wanting to promise something I couldn't deliver. It had taken this long just to get women even considered. I'll mention it to Nathaniel and see if he can convince the director to change the requirements. The forms haven't gone out to anyone except you all yet, I think. From the table, Betty said,
They'll send it out with the press release. Once that happens, it'll be set in stone.
I nodded, lips pressed together. Swallowing my pride, I walked over to the table where she sat and put one of the applications down in front of her. You have enough flight experience.
And a master's in journalism. Pretty sure that's not the sort of advanced degree they're looking for.
It's still worth trying. I slid it toward her. Right? She nodded but didn't reach for the application. Instead, she shook herself like a dog just out of a pond and reached for her purse.
I've been carrying this around for months, hoping you'd come back. I should have just forwarded it, but I don't know. I think I was afraid you'd throw it out.
Cocking my head, I stared at her as she fumbled around inside her purse. Why would I throw it out?
Because it was for me.
She pulled a battered envelope from her bag and put it on the table.
Or at least it would have been if I'd forwarded it.
Curious, I picked it up. The return address was from Life magazine. Just the name sent a flash of red across my vision with the memory of that anger. She was probably right. I probably would have tossed it if it had come right after the Girl Scout incident. Betty kept talking, fingers twisting the strap of her bag.
They sent it to me because I was the writer on record. It was addressed to you, but they didn't know where to send it, and I could have just sent it with Helen, I guess.
Inside the Life envelope was another one in better shape, with an unfamiliar, looping signature and Red Gables Home, Red Bank, South Carolina, as the return address. I sat down. Betty had opened the interior envelope, but I couldn't find it in myself to care. The curiosity would have been too much for her journalistic heart. I suppose I should be grateful that she didn't try to hide that she'd read it. The writing was the same looping, unfamiliar hand from the envelope.
Dear Dr. York, I'm writing on behalf of one of our patients who saw you on Watch Mr. Wizard. At the time, she said that you were her great-niece, but called you Anselma Wexler. We assumed that she was confused, as she is quite elderly and not always lucid. But when Life magazine came out, she saw you there and again referred to you as her niece. In this article, I noticed that Wexler was your maiden name, so I thought it best to reach out on the off chance that you are indeed related to our Miss Wexler. Esther Wexler. She had been living with a sister who has since passed away, but to the best of our knowledge has no other living family. Sincerely yours, Lorraine Purvis, RN.
The page shook in my hand and became impossible to read. I read it again. Aunt Esther was alive? I pressed my hand to my mouth to try to stop the noise I was making. It was high and thin and rose and fell, and I don't even know what to call it, but my aunt was alive and Herschel and I weren't alone, and I had to call him, and then we could go to Red Bank, South Carolina, and get Aunt Esther and...
Elma?
Nicole had a hand on my shoulder, then pulled me into an embrace.
Elma, sweetie, they're there. Shush now. There, there.
I called Nathaniel. Helen's words helped me catch my breath a little. No, no, I'm fine. Or at least that's what I tried to say. Whatever sound I made was enough to stop her, though, and it cut off my keening. I wiped my eyes with both hands.
the paper of the letter scraping against my cheeks. Sorry. That was embarrassing. Nicole kept me in an embrace.
Nonsense. Embarrassing is spilling wine on His Excellency, the Prince of Monaco, at a state dinner. This was just a moment of being human, and being human isn't embarrassing. Well, except maybe farting.
I laughed. Huh. God. Oh, thank God for Nicole. And then Helen put her lips together and blew out a raspberry. Perhaps my laughter was a little desperate, but at least that breathlessness made sense. Straightening, I wiped my eyes again, leaving streaks of mascara along the sides of my thumb. I must have looked a mess. Sorry. It was actually good news. My aunt? I had to take an unsteady breath to be able to continue. My aunt is alive.
When I pushed the door to our apartment open, Nathaniel was lying on the sofa reading a report. He lowered it, smiling.
You're home early.
He sat up, pages dropping all over the floor.
What's wrong?
5 different sentences competed for priority. What one was perhaps the least helpful.
I need to make a phone call.
Fortunately, Nicole had followed me upstairs after driving me home. She rested a hand on my shoulder.
Everything's okay, but Elma had a bit of a shock.
Right. I needed to give Nathaniel context, or he would only worry more.
Eddie got a letter from the Life magazine article, only it was for me, and...
I shook my head. None of that mattered.
And Esther is alive?
Oh, my God.
Nathaniel crossed the room and pulled me into his arms.
That is wonderful.
I sagged into his chest, and the weight of Nicole's hand left my shoulder. Behind me, the door closed with a quiet click. Nathaniel rocked me in his arms and let me cry out the past 5 years of grief.
I thought Herschel and I were alone. And yes, there was some small part of my brain that wondered. If Aunt Esther had survived, then who else might have? Maybe my parents were alive. But some of the tears came from knowing that they weren't. That no one who lived within 50 miles of Washington had survived. But, oh, we had an aunt again.
Sniffling and pulled back, wiping my eyes for the umpteenth time that day. I fished in my bag to pull out the letter.
I'm going to call the nursing home. I had made so many compromises with myself to find happiness. I had sat Shiva and gone through the entire mourning process for my family. I had put them in a box and buried them in my memories, in lieu of the earth. This exhumed them and left a raw scar in the ground of my mind. But it was a time of great joy, too.
Nathaniel's eyes were red. He gave a lopsided half-smile.
Well, if there's ever been a time to say L'chaim.
L'chaim. To life. Stepping back, he cleared the path from me to the phone.
Do you want me to go out or...
Don't you dare!
Walking to the phone took an unreasonable amount of energy, like escaping the gravity well of grief. I'll need someone to hand me tissues.
Tissues. Check. Confirmed tissues are go.
Snorting, I sat down on the sofa and reached for the phone. The number of the Red Gables nursing home was on the letterhead. 2 letters and 5 numbers later, the phone was ringing.
Good afternoon. Red Gables home.
The voice on the other end of the line was the soft, mellifluous stream of a native southerner. I could feel the shape of my words shift to match hers.
Yes? Could you please connect me with one of your residents? Esther Wexler? I'm sorry, Miss Wexler is at dinner now.
I'd half expected her to stay dead. Clearing my throat, I picked up one of the papers that Nathaniel had dropped.
May I leave a message, then?
The page had a preliminary trajectory for a launch from Brazil.
This is her niece. Dr. York?
Yes?
This is Lorraine Purvis. I wrote to you.
She gave a little laugh.
Lord, I can't believe you're really her niece. We just... Well, she just gets so confused sometimes. Sweet as anything, but... Listen... Why don't you hold on for just a minute and I'll go get her?
Oh, I don't want to be any trouble. It's fine. I won't pull her out of the dining room if she's still eating. Be right back.
The phone clunked against a desk or counter, and I could hear her footsteps tapping away in the distance. Nathaniel had moved across our studio to the kitchen and was taking the dishes out of the drying rack. The plates clattered against each other as he put them away in the cupboard. Cleaning was probably a good way to distract myself. I reached down to pick up the rest of the papers Nathaniel had dropped. The report had pages covered with equations in Helen's handwriting. Stacking them, it was hard not to look over the calculations. As a sign of how disordered my mind was, it took me a moment to recognize them as orbital trajectories for Brazil, Kenya, and Indonesia. All three spots were equatorial and had lower fuel consumption than anywhere in the United States or Europe. And all three had eastern coasts, which would be nice since it meant that a failed rocket would drop into water instead of... The phone rustled and clattered as someone picked it up.
Dr. York?
Yes?
One moment, I have your aunt here.
Thank you. I set the pages down on the coffee table and closed my eyes, waiting. The phone rustled, and then a voice like an aged and beloved canary flitted through the line.
Aunt Selma?
Aunt Esther! My voice cracked and the room blurred behind yet another veil of maddening tears. It was like hearing a ghost. What do you say to someone you thought was dead? For that matter, she must have thought the same of me until she saw me on Mr. Wizard. What came out of my mouth was a banal and safe social noise. How are you?
Well, 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 as I live and breathe. Isn't it wonderful to hear your voice?
I'm sorry, I only just got the letter. I didn't know.
Lance, child, I didn't know you were alive either. After Rose and I got out of Charleston, well, I thought it was just the two of us.
It was good that there was a phone line between us. At the sound of my grandmother's name, I had to move the phone away from my mouth and cover it for a moment. She had lived. When I read the letter, she had been living with a sister who has since passed away. I hadn't known which sister. God damn it. My grandmother had survived the tidal waves that swamped Charleston, and I had done nothing to find her.
28. Astronauts suffer bone loss. Special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, April 18th, 1957. The medical report on the astronauts who recently spent 43 days aboard the Luneta orbiting space platform illustrated how their organisms responded to the unprecedented conditions of prolonged life in space. The astronauts were found, for example, to have about 14% fewer red cells in their blood when they returned. Projecting the impact of such changes on future astronauts coming back after a long stay in space suggests that these returnees could become instant invalids on Earth. One goal of Luneta will be to see whether increased exercise in space slows down these adjustments so that future spacemen can become Earthmen again with minimal trouble.
When I put the phone down, Nathaniel looked up from the newspaper he had been reading. He'd long since finished putting the dishes away.
That sounded like a good phone call.
She's doing well. Standing, I rubbed my forehead, still a little shocked. But I don't think she's happy there. I was thinking...
You want her to move in with us?
He lowered the paper and leaned back in his chair.
What about going to live with Herschel?
I shrugged, crossing to join him at the table. Sure, she could. But he already has two kids, and I don't know that they need another mouth to feed. He grunted and drummed his fingers on the table.
We'd need a bigger place. And I'm willing to do that.
But... A studio was fine for the two of us, but adding a third really would be too much.
We can't afford a house yet, and paying more in rent for a larger place.
He spread his hands, trying not to call attention to the fact that we'd spent our savings to cover the damage to the plane in the air show.
It's something to think about.
Housing prices have come down. We haven't really looked for a place in a while, and there are those new subdivisions out by the Sunflower facility.
It's not just... My hesitation isn't just about the space.
If the IAC is moving the launch facilities to Brazil, then that might not be a good choice for Aunt Esther.
Nathaniel shrugged.
I mean, I could continue to work at Sunflower doing designs. For a while, anyway.
Oh. I gnawed the inside of my lip, thinking. Well, we aren't likely to make that move for at least a year while they do construction, right?
More likely two, since we still have to pick the site.
Nathaniel sat forward in his chair and took my hand.
But if you're accepted as an astronaut, then I know what their training schedule is like. Is that going to be fair to her?
You think I should leave her in a nursing home? I just found my aunt again, and now he expected me to leave her with strangers?
God, no.
He ran his free hand over his hair.
But if Herschel is willing to take her in, that might be a better choice in the long run. We don't have to make any decisions now, but it's worth thinking about.
2 weeks after I spoke with my aunt. 2 weeks after I called Herschel to let him know that she was alive. 2 weeks later, I was on the phone with my brother again, holding another letter in my shaking hand. I had taken a Milltown, but that only slowed my heart from a gallop to a trot.
National Weather Center, Herschel Wexler speaking.
Hey, it's Elma. Have you got a minute? The black plastic of the phone trapped sweat in my palm.
What's wrong?
Through the receiver, I could hear the sound of his office door shutting. I was just invited to move into the first round of testing for the astronaut program. The letter still shook in my hand. I'd somehow thought that they would tell me at work, but I'd gotten a form letter along with, I didn't know how many other women.
Mazel tov! Wait until I tell Rachel. She's going to be over the moon!
I groaned at the joke. You are the worst.
Seriously, though, I'm so proud of you. When do you go in?
Well, that's the problem. I finally sat down on the sofa and put the letter on the coffee table in front of me. It's the week we're scheduled to go visit Aunt Esther. And it's 5 full days of testing.
Oh.
Herschel shuffled some papers on his desk. He sighed.
Well, let me see if I can change my vacation request.
I'm sorry.
I twisted the cord in my hand. Or, there's really no reason for us both to go. You could do the testing and then come out to visit once we've got her settled.
The room seemed to get colder. I thought we were going to decide that once we saw her in person, you know, and talk to the nursing staff about what she needed. Herschel laughed in my ear.
Yeah, well, at that point, the concern had been your schedule, not whether you were on the planet.
We don't know that I'm going to get in.
Please, Elma. They'd be idiots not to hire you, for publicity reasons, if nothing else.
That's not how the space agency works. Everything about the space program was complex and dangerous. There's no way they would fly someone unqualified just for publicity reasons, at least not until things were established. Everyone who goes up now has to be able to work. Who knows what testing will show?
Right, uh-huh. You'll owe me the newest Black Hawk comic if I'm right, which I am.
My big brother could sound so cocksure sometimes.
And you also needed time to find a new place, right? That's why we were waiting until next month.
Yes. The newspaper lay across the room on the kitchen table, still folded in a tidy bundle. Nathaniel and I would have to go through the classified ads tonight.
Do you really want to be house shopping and move in while preparing for these tests?
Why did he have to be right? I leaned forward to rest my elbow on my knee and rubbed my forehead. Parker, after all, had said he'd make sure I never saw space, so maybe I should focus on what I could do for my family. Maybe that's not where my priority should be. I mean, shouldn't I be planning for what I can control instead of some random thing that might happen?
Elma.
I could imagine Herschel glaring over the rim of his glasses at me. He'd confessed once that he actually couldn't see that way, but it looked fairly intimidating.
You are not going to be happy unless you try for this.
What if I don't get in? He laughed at me.
If you don't get in, I'll buy you a subscription to Mystery in Space.
Good. I'll need it to drown my sorrows.
Look, the flight will have to do a layover somewhere.
Why don't I see if I can find a route through Kansas City? Aunt Esther will probably need to rest anyway, so we can spend the night and you can see her, hmm?
Gee, you mean it? His ability to reduce me to a kid again is remarkable. And my hands had stopped shaking to boot. Maybe you'll even be here for a rocket launch. A living aunt and making the first cut in the astronaut application process. When I went to work the next day, I was still vibrating with joy. Even the linoleum of the IAC seemed brighter. Before we went down our separate hallways, Nathaniel leaned in to kiss my cheek.
Careful, you're going to blind someone with that smile.
Don't worry. It'll go away as soon as I see what your engineers have mucked up this time. He laughed and gave my hand a squeeze before sauntering down to his office. Even from down the hall, the computer department had the hum of morning arrival, the air chirping with bright conversation full of recipe exchanges and compliments on dresses. Once we started working, it became all math and slide rules and the rattle of the Frieden calculator. Lately, there was the occasional curse as the IBM overheated. Again. When I rounded the corner into the room, Masira was sitting on our shared desk, waving her hands in the air as if she were conducting a symphony.
Chandeliers everywhere. I had no idea. And the singing. Oh, they were wonderful.
Myrtle shook her head.
Gee, all we did was go bowling. It was our league night.
What's going on? I set my bag on the desk and began working at the buttons on my coat. As much as I wanted to blurt out that I'd been selected for the first round of testing, Masira had the floor.
Hank took me over to the Missouri side to see a show last night.
She clapped her hands.
It was to die for. In the Midland Theater. It was as if someone said, could we put more decoration here? And then answered, yes, every time. Even the toilets were ornamented.
I shrugged out of my coat, resolutely not saying that I'd made the first cut. I can't think of the last time we went to a show.
Well, if you get a chance.
She broke off, looking past me.
Jeez, Helen. Are you okay?
Just allergies.
Helen waved her hand with a smile, but her eyes were red and swollen. Her shoulders drooped. Her voice had a rough burr. Oh, hell. She hadn't made the cut. I did not announce at work that I'd made the first cut, but at the 99s? Well, I wouldn't be able to avoid the topic there. When Sunday rolled around, I went out to the airfield with the letter in my bag. I still wasn't comfortable around Betty. True, she'd reunited me with my aunt, but she'd carried the letter around for months. She could have given it to Helen or Nicole to deliver, so once again, I felt like she was manipulating and using me. Pearl had brought a pound cake, which was sitting in the middle of the table inside the hangar. Ida and Imogen huddled inside their coats. Nicole had taken off one glove to eat cake. Even with the doors closed, my breath frosted white until I got right next to the table and the tiny space heater under it. My ankles scorched while my fingers froze.
Ooh, cake!
Brilliant conversationalist, I know. It was that or talk about how big Pearl was getting. If she wasn't carrying twins, I'd be stunned.
I was just in a baking mood, I guess.
She rubbed her stomach with one hand. Nicole looked at the clock.
Just missing Helen.
As if that summoned her, the door to the hangar opened with a bang. Helen stood in the door with a bag over her shoulder. She came in, slamming it behind her. At least she wasn't sad anymore. She looked at me, then the rest of the group.
My application was rejected.
Mine too. Ida raised her hand. Not that it surprises anyone.
I cleared my throat. I'm in.
Me too.
Nicole set her cake down, brushing the crumbs off her skirt. Imogen shook her head.
Rejected due to insufficient experience with jet engines.
They took me.
Meddy shifted to look at Pearl.
What about you?
I didn't apply.
She ran her hand over the arc of her stomach.
We'll wait until the colony is established and then see.
The silence in the hangar grew palpable. Outside, the buzz of airplanes said that the world continued on, but in here, something had broken. Even though we were all bunched together around the table, a jagged line ran through our group. Having some in and some not was bad enough, but the racial lines were so clear.
Helen broke the silence and upended her bag on the table. Manuals and textbooks flopped open. I caught one as it slid toward the edge of the table. It was a manual for T-33. From the pile, Helen pulled out a steno pad. These are the airfields with jet planes.
But the deadline is past.
Nicole shook her head.
I mean, it's terrible, but what can you do?
I can be ready next time.
Helen glared at her, then turned her attention